Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Jennifer Frisch preside.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is July 30, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar this morning. The first one is A23-1687. Olson Baker versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal at your option. We ask that you introduce yourself and your client before you begin speaking and let us know how we can reference you this morning. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that is permitted. I think with that, we're ready to go whenever you are, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amy Lawler, and I represent the appellant, Darius Olson Baker. This case presents a straightforward suppression issue. Under both the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution and the Minnesota Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, a warrantless search or seizure is per se unreasonable unless it is within an established exception to the warrant requirement. If the state fails to meet its burden of establishing the applicability of any such exception, the search or seizure is unlawful, and any evidence obtained as a result must be suppressed. The state bears this burden. Here, after the state charged Darius Olson Baker with being a felon in possession of a firearm, the defense moved for an order suppressing evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution as the defendant was unlawfully seized.
But was the evidence obtained as a result of his seizure? Because the evidence that we're talking about is the gun, right?
Yes.
And the gun is located in the snow outside of the car, not on his person, not in his vehicle, right?
Right.
So what is the discovery of the evidence tied to his seizure?
Yes.
How is that?
First and foremost, because the parties agreed that it was. The stipulation on the parties was binding. It's a big deal to
move
forward.
The state stipulated that the state stipulated to what?
The exact wording of the stipulated facts trial agreement under Rule 2601 Subdivision 4 is in Document 25 of the record. The language is, the prosecutor acknowledges and agrees that the court's ruling on the following pretrial issue is dispositive of the case or that a trial will be unnecessary if the defendant prevails on appeal. Denial of motion to suppress firearm as a result of unconstitutional seizure / arrest.
But that's not a stipulation that the firearm was discovered as a result of the seizure of your client.
It's an agreement that the ruling on the motion to suppress is dispositive of the case. And the motion was to suppress the firearm. So the question of whether or not the court erred in denying the motion to suppress the firearm as a result of an unconstitutional seizure or arrest is a dispositive issue in the case.
Let me ask it a different way. What is your client's expectation of privacy in the gun that's found in a public place?
Well, I think that actually goes perhaps to the kind of the issue that the state is raising now of attempting to get out of the stipulated facts agreement and move into a broader question of whether or not there is no expectation of privacy or whether the gun was somehow discovered outside of the realm of a search or a seizure. And that wasn't what the parties agreed to. And it's certainly not, there is no case law that says that, for example, tossing a gun or drugs or any other item following the beginning of a seizure is in some way removes that item as a result of a fruit of a poisonous tree as a result of the search.
Well, but the vehicle was already stopped. He was out of the car.
Yes.
So it's not, I mean, I can go along with you to the extent that the stop is part of it and the contraband or whatever is tossed because law enforcement is trying to stop the individual or the car. But here we've got somebody who's already stopped. I mean, there was a lawful reason for law enforcement to go see, like, does this person need help? I mean, to invest, right? I mean, that the squad turned on its lights the officer turned on the squad's lights and then stopped. I mean, that's, you're not claiming that's unlawful somehow or another, or are you?
I'm certainly not claiming that the idea generally of stopping to render aid is unlawful, but the issue here goes far beyond that. And this is an issue where neither party ever argued or asked the court to address the question of whether the gun was abandoned before a seizure began, and that neither party argued.
What is your theory of when the seizure began then?
Well, I think there's two
in
parts.
In this case, yeah.
Yeah, there's two parts to that answer. One is that the parties essentially agreed it did not matter, that the entire case was analyzed with the understanding that if the seizure was unlawful at any point.
No, that's not the question I'm asking. Okay. What is your theory? Because you're saying that,
yes,
that when it started matters on whether this property could be viewed as abandoned, assuming we could get around or figure we could get around the stipulation, because I understand your argument there about the stipulation. So what is when did the seizure begin in this case?
I think that's a multi-part answer. I think it begins when the police officer pulls up, turns on his lights, suspects an ambush, and calls for backup after he sees my client duck up and then duck down. That's when he believes that a crime is afoot, and that's when the district court's findings indicate that he had reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime because that behavior of ducking up and down was so highly unusual. And I disagree, though, with the idea that this wouldn't matter in terms of the stipulation that the parties entered into, because, you know, that's the core of a stipulated facts trial, is the agreement that the ruling on the seizure is dispositive. And, you know, that's certainly an issue that can be litigated, the question of abandonment. You know, this court decided State v. Davis in 2018 with a very similar issue of essentially not necessarily clear when the seizure began. They tell a guy to stop after he's walking away. He tosses something after they start following him, but before they tell him to stop. And, you know, the court rejects the idea of abandonment, but still that abandonment issue is litigated here.
Isn't it two pieces, though, right? So you have the question of whether he sees. Let's assume that he was seized illegally. But isn't the next question is, what is the fruit of that seizure? What happened as a result of that seizure? I didn't see the district court necessarily deciding that issue, and I don't know if the stipulation necessarily captures that question. So we could say, yeah, he's seized. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I think you're wrong for two reasons. One is I do think that the court did decide the issue. The district court, on page 4 of its Rasmussen order, that June 21st, 2023 order, it's page 4. It has two conclusions of law. They're short, but they're there. One is that the officer conducted a lawful Terry stop of defendant, and two, that he was not arrested. And so it's that first part.
But it's not saying that the gun was the fruit of the seizure. That's my point. And I don't see it in the memorandum either.
I disagree, because then it's that then when we go on to the memorandum, and even up into the last line on page 4 of the memorandum portion of the order, which was that the motion to suppress the fruits of the stop is denied, I don't think that anywhere there was any argument that this was not the fruit of the stop. And that's certainly true in the transcript of the proceeding as well as in the district court's order. There is nowhere that any party ever agreed that the gun was abandoned such that this would be outside the realm of a search or seizure inquiry, or that the question of the fruit of the seizure was somehow divorced from the question of the lawfulness of the seizure itself.
Stop or the seizure?
Counsel, you've got me confused.
Okay.
I mean, an officer clearly has the right to stop.
Yes.
And investigate. And later arrest when probable cause develops. Isn't this just a classic Terry where there's a legitimate stop, a temporary seizure while it's being investigated, and as part of that, the discovery of the gun, which leads to the probable cause for his arrest?
Well,
everything then comes in.
I agree with you that this is certainly a quintessential Terry seizure and then pat frisk issue. What I disagree with you is the question of whether reasonable and articulable suspicion can arise simply because someone who has just been in a single car accident on a snowy Minnesota night, who ducks up when he sees a car approaching, ducks down again, and then ducks up, and then emerges with wet hands, wearing a fanny pack, has created a reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime.
Don't think that's reasonable and articulable suspicion?
Absolutely.
Certainly not on a whim or a hunch.
I disagree that there's not a single case law in existence in Minnesota that this would indicate that it is anything more than a whim or a hunch. The idea that somehow a person who's been in an accident in the snow would have wet hands, or that a person who has been in a single car accident, presumably a little bit dazed and shaken up, and then hears a car coming up behind him, at that point, no lights are on. So they duck up, ascertain who it is, duck down again, and then emerge with wet hands.
You don't think that's suspicious behavior?
I would certainly want to know if it was a friend or a foe after dark on the side of a snowy highway at 10 p.m. on a February evening, February night. I would want to know. And the idea that somehow a person...
be out in the sticks, we don't think the same way, but I certainly wouldn't behave like that unless I was a bad guy.
Well, then let's take that from there, and let's assume you wouldn't. So then you have a suspicion. But then that needs something more. It needs to be a reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime, of criminal activity. And right now, the officer doesn't ever indicate that he suspected a crime. What he says is, this is unusual. I haven't seen this before. I've been an officer for 2 years, and I've never seen anyone duck up and down before. That alone is a hunch. It's a whim. It's a generalized suspicion that something is off. It is not a reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime. And
but don't officers and lay people have a lot of knowledge that people try to hide things when they're doing something they shouldn't be doing, and they face a situation like this? I mean, it happens all the times in the alcohol context where they try to get rid of the beer or whatever it might be.
Sure, and in this case, of course, the officer didn't stop the Mr. Olson Baker is on the suspicion of a crime initially. He did pull up because Mr. Olson Baker was in a single car accident. And so that alone, a person who's been in an accident and then, you know, is hunched down for any number of reasons that you might hunch down next to your car if your car has just slid off the road, doesn't then transform that into a reasonable and articulable suspicion of a crime.
The fact that it slid off the road is suspicious and goes to whether he was maybe impaired in driving under the influence. And why wouldn't you be looking for a beer can he might have thrown or something else?
Well, in this case, that wasn't the fact pattern. The fact pattern was that the officer pulled up, and then the act of him ducking up and down is what caused him to believe it was an ambush, activate the emergency lights, and call for backup. So in that moment, simply the act of standing up and down again is what generated this officer's claim of a reasonable and articulable suspicion. And there is no case law in Minnesota or under the federal constitution that would allow that movement of standing up and down when you're next to your car after it's been in an accident, especially when you're looking in the dark to see who is pulled up behind you, that creates a reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal activity. And that's really the core of this case, is that the court initially finds, the district court finds that it is, well, there's certainly no case law to support that. And then the seizure and later search expands based on wet hands and a fanny pack with a zipper open. And again, there's no case law that would indicate that an open purse or fanny pack or anything else that has a zipper open, or that someone who's been in the snow and then has wet hands, in either scenario or combined, would create a reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal activity that would vastly expand the scope of search and seizure law.
Counsel, what would you have the officer do here? Just leave and leave him out alongside the road?
The officer chose to stop to render aid, but then immediately chose not to render aid and instead call for backup in fear for an ambush. And so, yes, I think the officer had multiple options. He certainly could have gone and actually asked him if he needed aid. He could have driven by, or he could have continued to do these things, but if he wanted to search, he needed a warrant. And that's the core of the Fourth Amendment and the Minnesota Constitution, is that when you actually seize a person and then search it and find something that is indicative of a crime, you need a warrant, or the state has to prove an exception.
What did they search? They didn't search him, and they didn't search the car to find this guy. They searched the open fields.
Yes, but they seized him first. And there was no question that either party agreed to that, or that the state, or that the district court found that.
Does he need to agree to with a police officer to search the
open field? Where's the case law that would support that?
No, the issue here is the seizure preceded the search. And there's no question that the search was the open field, was that snowy bank on the side of the road. That wasn't his person.
You started your argument with talking about warrantless searches and seizures.
Yes.
And this goes back to my original questioning, and that is, why does the officer need a warrant to search the area where he discovered the contraband, which is in a public place?
Because the seizure preceded that. And that's certainly the line of Terry cases that continue. And I think that question is specifically answered in the Davis decision in 2018. The site for that is 910 Northwest 2nd 50, which is that if the seizure happens first and then the item is discovered in, you know, a public area, but it's discovered as a result of that seizure, and the item was placed there in anticipation of that seizure as well, in either of those scenarios, it does become a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Counsel, anytime you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Shannon Harmon, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and representing the state of Minnesota in this case. The sole question in this matter is whether the district court properly denied appellant's motion to suppress a firearm he claims was found as a result of an unconstitutional search and seizure. As has been discussed, the court has two grounds upon which it can affirm the district court's refusal to suppress the firearm: abandonment and the totality of the circumstances. But the court need only address abandonment. Jumping right into whether or not, I'm happy to answer any questions.
That,
but yes.
I mean, Ms. Lawler, I think, was arguing, wait a minute, the stipulation itself says search and seizure in it. The state didn't raise this argument below. And so the defendant was making his decision on whether to proceed with the stipulated facts trial or not based on attacking the search. So isn't it kind of unfair now to, I mean, I know we can under the case law, but should we then, if we go down that path of abandonment and say, yes, it was abandoned property, should we send it back to the district court and allow the defendant, the appellant, to withdraw the stipulated facts agreement?
It's not.
There does seem to be an element there that.
It's not unfair, Your Honor. It is true the state did not raise the abandonment argument below, and I cannot answer why that is. However, this is part of the stipulation. The stipulation does use the term search and seizure. Denial of motion to suppress firearm as a result of an unconstitutional search, seizure, and arrest. Appellant actually describes in his brief, the parties agreed that the district court's ruling on this pretrial suppression motion was dispositive. But abandonment goes exactly to the issue of whether or not the firearm was discovered as a result of an unconstitutional search and seizure. This court has found a number of times, the Supreme Court has found in a long line of cases, that the first inquiry in addressing a search and seizure issue is to first question whether or not there has been a search or seizure. Now, there was. We agree there was a search and a seizure at some point. The state contends that that did not start until appellant voluntarily walked over to the officer after the officer had rightfully stopped. But abandonment occurred prior to that search, and the state's cases have found repeatedly that abandonment prior to the search and seizure is not an unconstitutional search. It is an abandonment of the expectation of privacy. Counsel just
argued.
But
the district court didn't make any findings about abandonment. And I don't know how the gun got there.
The district court did not make any findings about abandonment. That issue was not raised.
However, I don't know if it was just ejected from the car as a result of the accident, which maybe isn't abandonment. Maybe that's happenstance, right?
That could be, Your Honor.
However, then what do we do with that?
However, this is a de novo review. The court's review of...
It's de novo, but we can't... But what if we can't tell from the facts? I mean, what if this is like a credibility question? about the evidence or weighing the evidence to determine how that gun got there? Is it a result of the affirmative acts of the defendant?
I don't think it matters, Your Honor. The gun is in, the gun has been abandoned. It is some 10 to 15 feet, I believe, away from the car. There's no snow on top of it. It has been left there. I don't believe it matters whether or not it was ejected from the car or whether he threw it. It is now abandoned. It is in a public place. He has no expectation of privacy in the roadway.
Let me ask it a different way. Is it you? Are you conceding that the discovery of the gun is as a result of the seizure of the defendant?
No. The discovery of the gun, the abandonment of the gun was abandoned prior to a search and seizure. That is the inquiry in abandonment cases.
Did a search then even occur? I mean, looking at in a public place, is that a Fourth Amendment search?
No, I don't believe the finding of the gun was actually the result of a search and seizure. Okay. The gun was abandoned. It would have been found. It may have been found just looking around the car. And so it's not because he was seized that the gun was found. That he was seized and he was then placed into the vehicle so that the officers could so the officer could secure the scene. It would have made absolutely no sense to allow him to then walk around when the officer thought there may have been evidence of a crime, possibly a firearm lying around. And so the officer rightfully placed him away from the scene, but the discovery of the gun was not a result of the seizure, and I don't believe that matters in the abandonment analysis. Once the expectation of privacy is abandoned, pursuant to the Vaughn case.
Aren't we just dealing with a stop until the gun was found?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Aren't we just dealing with a stop and investigate until the gun was found, and then we're dealing with an arrest?
Well, we're not dealing with a stop at first, Your Honor. We're dealing with an officer who doesn't know what's going on, has a right to stop and find out and render aid.
I understand, but he's controlling this guy's behavior by putting him in the squad car. So in a sense, he's stopped the guy from doing any more hiding of evidence or anything else at that point.
That's true. At that point, there is a seizure, but under the case law, under Vaughn in particular, the police may hold the person and discover something that was left. I believe in Vaughn it was a syringe left under a counter.
Of Terry, you freeze the scene. You develop whatever facts are appropriate given initially a limited period of time for a stop to investigate, and once you find the gun, you arrest him.
Well, to clarify, the state does also contend that this is an appropriate search and seizure under Terry if we get to that, but I don't believe that the abandonment prior to the seizure is to be ignored just because it develops into a stop, into a Terry stop. The gun was still abandoned prior to the stop. In order to hold otherwise, then would almost render abandonment meaningless, I guess, in many cases, because the abandonment of the expectation of privacy occurs whether or not it develops further into a stop.
But isn't it just basically reasonable suspicion to detain this person temporarily while you investigate? Once you find the gun, you have probable cause and you arrest him.
Absolutely. I believe that's also appropriate, Your Honor. There was reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Even to talk about abandonment. We don't care about that.
Well, because in this case, under a de novo review, the gun was abandoned, and therefore it wasn't obtained as the result of a Terry stop. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wasn't his intent arguably to keep it away from the police, so he was hiding it temporarily until he could retrieve it at a later time? He wasn't abandoning it.
That is at least a temporary abandonment of the expectation of privacy, and that's the case in many, if not most or all, of the abandonment cases, is that someone may be coming back to retrieve it. I believe in Vaughn, he sticks an eyeglass case with a syringe under a counter. Maybe he was going to come back and get it, maybe not. I don't think that's part of the inquiry, whether or not they were going to come back and get it. They have abandoned the expectation of privacy at that time. But getting into the totality of the circumstances and reasonable, articulable suspicion, Your Honor, that also exists here as well. I do want to address that counsel argued that there are a number of innocent explanations for the various actions that gave rise to the articulable suspicion in this case. The ducking behind the car, maybe all kinds of innocent explanations for that, the pack over the chest, the unzipped pack, and the wet hands. But the court credited the officer's testimony on all of these, first of all, and indicated that in the officer's experience assisting thousands of motorists, he had never seen a motorist duck behind a car when he approached to render aid. In addition, in his training, indicated to him that these packs are often worn on the front in such a manner for concealing weapons. And certainly in the dark of a February night in the snow, if you watch the dash camera and the body-worn camera, you can see it is quite dark until he arrives. The totality of these circumstances gave rise to articulable suspicion. And just because there are innocent explanations, the Minnesota courts and the U.S. Supreme Court have found a number of times that innocent explanations, that just because there are innocent explanations for certain facts does not mean that they cannot be part of a totality of the circumstances inquiry. And in fact, they often are. Courts have admitted that sometimes innocent activity may form a totality of the circumstances that arises to the level of an articulable suspicion. Unless the court has any additional questions, I have nothing further and ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of appellant's motion to suppress.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. It appears we have no additional questions. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 3 points. The first goes to the heart of your questions about abandonment and whether abandonment is a factual question that the district court would have needed to find because, of course, this court defers to the factual findings of the court. And, of course, that's true. Right now, there are no findings as to when or how the gun got to be in the field because no party ever made an argument about abandonment and no party ever argued that the timing or the manner in which the gun got to the field mattered. And I think there are important reasons for this that exist in case law. And if the state had argued abandonment at the district court, we certainly would be in arguments about State v. Davis. We'd be in arguments about In Re Welfare of EDJ, which is 502 Northwest 2nd, 779. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1993. There are certainly well-reasoned decisions from this court and from the Minnesota Supreme Court on the question of abandonment, including whether abandonment before an unlawful direction to stop is still a fruit of a poisonous tree, as well as a question of whether abandonment after a direction to stop or after a seizure is fruit of a poisonous tree. But that question never reached this district court, and so no fact findings were ever made as to when or how the gun got into the field.
Credibility finding. The officer remained concerned for his safety. The court finds the officer's continuing safety concerns were reasonable. So, how if we were going your direction, I mean, aren't we redeciding the district court's credibility findings here? Because that seems like a legitimate reason then to do the frisk, which is all that the officer did in terms of searching appellant.
So there's two parts to my answer. One is that that's a legal question about whether or not there was reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity. We are not asking you to disturb the court's factual findings on the credibility of the officer's suspicion that there was some
general... Is that a separate issue? So you're saying that the officer's the officer had no right to stay there, so he should have gotten back in a squad and left, so he wouldn't have been concerned for his safety, so he couldn't have done the Terry prep. I mean, is that...
No. Because certainly officers are allowed to have concerns for their safety, and that is a separate inquiry from whether a warrantless...
Is that what we're dealing with here?
No, because that's... You can... There are plenty of officers that...
What is the exact problem, then? I mean, that they went looking out in the snow? I mean, I guess we're asking the same questions over and over again.
No, but I think that... Perhaps part of the holdup is that this wasn't just a pat frisk. Of course, there's a seizure that always precedes a pat frisk. Here, the court doesn't decide when the seizure began because neither party asked them to, because the parties agreed that regardless if the search or seizure was or arrest was unlawful.
There was no finding of a seizure. I mean, that's right, and I think that's critical, right? Because the district court said this was a Terry frisk, and the officer's
I disagree. The court did find, for example, that Mr. Olsenbaker was not free to leave on multiple occasions, including at the time of the pat frisk that occurred. He was not free to leave. He was seized. We don't know if he was free to leave before that or after that. The court was not asked to decide. But the fundamental question on the stipulated facts proceeding was whether or not the seizure was lawful, the search and seizure was lawful. And so the question of when or how the gun was found after the seizure and the stop and the seizure are not somehow divorced or unrelated. The case law is very clear that it doesn't have to be found on the person. The question is still the lawfulness. My time is expired. If I can briefly answer, the question, of course, is not investigation; it's seizure. And ultimately, the question is the fruit of the poisonous tree, which was the question that the party stipulated to. But it's not a question of investigation; it's that very specific question about the reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal activity. And amorphous fears of security or unusual conduct just don't rise to that higher standard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate your submissions and your arguments. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time period.